You should have this. P. I opened the envelope and slid the book out. It was a first edition of In Our Time. I sank to the edge of my bed and sat there studying the cover. Bill came through the door not long after. He took in the book at a glance and said, "Purcell?" I nodded. "To the victor go the spoils." "Here," he said, and took his Waterman fountain pen from his pocket and tossed it on my bed. "Bill, what are you doing? I can't take that." "Oh, I think you can. It's mine, it's yours, right?" Bill went to his desk, opened the drawer, rummaged for something, then slammed it shut and stood facing out the window. He was leaning on the desktop with both hands as if trying to push it through the floor. "I'm sorry he didn't pick your story," I said. "I'm glad he chose mine, but I'm sorry he didn't choose yours." "Is that all you can think about? Ernest fucking Hemingway? He couldn't have chosen mine. I never handed one in." "Why not?" "What none of your business." He turned and looked at me. "Have you ever been inside a synagogue?"
"No."
"Well, once, on a field trip." "That's not what I mean."
"Then no."
"You're a Catholic, aren't you?"
"Well, not exactly."
"You used to go into town with the Catholic boys."
"For a while, not anymore. Not since fourth form."
"So, you're a lapsed Catholic. The point is, you were raised Catholic."
"Yes."
"So it's fair to say you haven't had the experience of doing what this person in your story does."
"What's that?"
You know.
"Well, that's not exactly true."
"Don't give me that shit." "Okay, so you've taken an interest in this person's situation. So you imagined what it's like. Bully for you. That doesn't make it your situation. It isn't your situation. And it isn't your story. That was my story, you fucking leech. That was my story, and you know it."
I've been all set to explain myself right up to the moment he called me a leech. But now I just shrugged and said,
"If it was your story, you would have written it." "Oh, it's as simple as that."
"Yeah, as simple as that."
By the time I got back to the room after dinner, I'd cooled off and was ready to tell Bill my side of things. It wouldn't make us friends, but it might make him understand how the story was really my own. I waited for an hour or so, and when he still didn't show up, I figured I'd find him in the library. The scholar's studies were in the basement. Five of them, awarded to the highest-ranking sixth formers at the start of each year. The basement had its own entrance, so they could come and go even when the rest of the library was closed. I didn't like it down there. The air was dead, the long shelves of periodicals depressing in the sheer dusty mass of their obsolescence. The place appeared to be empty that warm May night. No sound at all, no lights showing under the doors. I knocked on Bill's anyway, then tried the handle. I shouldn't have. I had no business doing that, and no business reading the notebook on his desk. But I took it out of the study and slumped down at the far end of a row of shelves and began to leaf through it under the dim yellow light. Over 100 handwritten pages without a title, without chapters, without any discernible form. I didn't read every word, but I read most of it. Enough to be overcome by its nakedness and misery and to understand why he could never have shown a page of it to anyone. After classes that Friday afternoon, a boy came to my room and said I should go to the dean's office. I didn't think anything of it. Hemingway would be here the following week, and I assumed Dean Makepeace wanted to give me some tips on how to handle myself with his old friend. It was hot and steamy. We sixth formers had the privilege of sunbathing on the quad,
And at this hour the grass was crowded with pale, hairy boys, basting themselves with oil as they yelled back and forth over their transistor radios, all tuned to the same station, the same song. I stopped to shoot the breeze with a couple of classmates, then ambled on. Mrs. Busk, the dean's secretary, was a short woman with a jutting bosom and a scattering of moles across her face. She was leaning out of her office when I arrived, peering down the hallway. "Where have you been?" she said. "They're all waiting." "They?" She went to Dean Makepeace's door and knocked. "He's here," she said, then stepped back. "Go in." The headmaster was standing in front of Dean Makepeace's desk. He motioned me to a chair on his left. In the three chairs lined up across from mine sat Mr. Ramsey, Mr. Lambert, and a boy named Goss, president of the Student Honor Council. Mr. Lambert was my French master, a dapper, pipe-smoking Parisian, whose collars always looked too tight. Dean Makepeace wasn't there. Despite the air conditioner rattling in one of the windows, the room was hot, and Mr. Ramsey's round, ruddy face glistened like a ham. I didn't know what this was about, but there'd been rumors of cheating on a French final earlier that week. I was clean and hadn't seen anything that I should have reported. The headmaster leaned back against the desk and stared at the floor between my feet. He had not looked directly at me since I came in. "All right," he said. "Let's hear it." "Sir?" "I'm sure you have a story for us. We're ready to hear it."
"It's very simple," Mr. Lambert said. "Tell the truth."
"I'm sorry," I said. "I don't understand."
"You're only making it worse," Goss said. He was a skinny, high-voiced boy with one leg and a brace from polio. I voted for him, but I didn't like him.
"So," the headmaster said, "you can think of no reason for our being here today." He kept his eyes on the floor as he spoke. I had the feeling he was deliberately denying me recognition. Usually his brilliant gaze held mine. But in its absence, I found myself staring at the wen on his forehead. "Well, honestly, sir, I'm at a loss."
"Ha!" Goss said.
"Please," Mr. Lambert said to him. "On se calme." The headmaster reached across his desk and picked up a piece of paper and handed it to me. It was a photocopy of the first page of Summer Dance, as it had appeared in Cantiamo. The line below the title said, "By Susan Friedman." The name threw me. I'd completely forgotten it. It had flown my mind as soon as I'd begun reading the story that night at the Troubadour office, and seen my own life laid bare on the page. And in all the time since then, I'd never thought of Summer Dance as anyone's story but mine. And I still didn't. Not really. Even with the proof in hand, even knowing that someone named Susan Friedman had written the story, I still thought of it as mine. I couldn't reconcile what I knew to be true with what I felt to be true. In fact, I couldn't think at all. My eyes moved back and forth between, "I hope nobody saw me pick up the cigarette butt," that sentence that had been so hard to write, and the name above it, Susan Friedman.
"Now, do you understand why you're here?" the headmaster said. I nodded.
"How did this happen?" Mr. Ramsey asked. There was no reproach in his tone, only the question itself, and I turned to him with gratitude and the will to give an answer, but none came. I looked at him, then down at the sheet of paper in my hand, my eyes drawn again to that name as if it might yet change back into mine.
"Nothing to say," Mr. Lambert said.
When I didn't answer, he shrugged and shook his head.
"You've dishonored our class," Goss said.
"You should know how this came to our attention,"
the headmaster said, still looking at the carpet. He explained how the faculty advisor to Miss Cobb's student newspaper came upon Summer Dance in her exchange copy of our news and immediately recognized it as the story that had caused such a stir at Miss Cobb's some years ago. A dramatic rift between two girls, others taking sides, a great deal of unpleasantness all around. I tell you this so that you will have at least some inkling of the harm you have caused our school, the headmaster said. This is not a local matter. You have exposed us to contempt and ridicule, at least, at Miss Cobb's, and far beyond if the story gets out, as it almost certainly will. The newspapers had a carnival last year over the Biltmore incident, and that was nothing compared to this. Mere drunkenness. But this. Just watch them. Ernest Hemingway? The name is catnip to those people. He stopped and closed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose. Well, plagiarism's bad enough, Goss said. But from a girl? I can't believe you'd plagiarize from a girl. It's a damn good story, Mr. Ramsey said. Whoever wrote it. Schools like ours are vulnerable to criticism, the headmaster said softly, as if to himself. There is some truth in these criticisms. Too much truth. But we are trying to do something here. We are trying to become something different and even admirable. And for this effort, we need all the loyalty we can draw on. More than loyalty. Love. It is the love of the old boy for the school that makes everything possible. And how do you think the old boy will feel when he picks up his Times or his Globe and sees our name associated with a low, shameless, asinine hoax like this? Ernest Hemingway, galled and embarrassed by one of our own. I'm sorry, I said. You have no idea of the damage you have done. No idea. Here, already, today. And later, to boys such as yourself, and such as I was. Boys whose bills are paid by others. And did we treat you so badly, Mr. Lambert said, that you should think so little of us? No, sir, never. I love this school, too. Then I pity your wife and kids, Goss said, if you ever have any. Enough of that, Mr. Ramsey said. And what am I to tell Ernest Hemingway, the headmaster said. Good God. He looked at me for the first time. He studied me up and down. Do you really have nothing to say? No, sir. Only that I'm sorry. Well, that may be a good thing for you. It's no use to us. So, here we are. Mr. Lambert and Mr. Ramsey will collect what you need for the trip home. We'll send the rest on. The train leaves at 5. Your father has already been notified.
The class of 1961 is the best class this school ever had, Goss said. And now you've blackened its name.
Oh, please, Mr. Ramsey said. Goss slouched in his chair. You understand, the headmaster said, that I will have to advise Columbia that you failed to complete your studies here, and that I cannot vouch for your character. They will withdraw their offer.
Oh.
You do understand? There's to be no confusion about this.
Yes, I understand.
Foolish boy, Mr. Lambert said. I looked at him and saw tears in his eyes. If, after 4 years with us, you could do this, the headmaster said, then you have understood nothing of what we are. You have never really entered the school. So be it. As far as this school is concerned, you were never here.
That is
"Very hard, sir," Mr. Ramsey said.
"Do you think so, Mr. Ramsey?"
"I do." "Maybe you're right."
"You must do better," he said to me,
and walked across the room and out the door.
"You're excused."
"Now," Mr. Ramsey said to Goss, who'd pushed himself up and turned toward me. "I just wanted to wish him luck." Goss offered me his hand, and I disgusted myself by taking it.
"Well," he said, "good luck."
Mr. Lambert followed him to the door and then closed it again.
"We'll fill one suitcase and send the rest on," Mr. Ramsey said. "Is there anything in particular you need for the trip?"
"No, sir."
"Nothing," Mr. Lambert said. "I wanted to ask them to pack my first edition of In Our Time, but bringing up Hemingway at just this moment felt like a bad idea."
"I can't think of anything," I said.
"Give Mrs. Busk the combination of your gymnasium locker. We'll clean it out later. Do you have a study?"
"No."
"Please wait here," Mr. Ramsey said. I sat where they left me. The window was closed, but I could still hear shouts and laughter and faint music from the quad. I'd been noticing those sounds from the moment I entered the office, and how they went on no matter what was being said and done in here. They were the sounds I lived with day after day, ordinary and subliminal as my own pulse. Yet throughout this meeting I was sharply aware of them, and they distracted me from the actuality of what was happening. During our worst dreams we are assured by a dog barking somewhere, a refrigerator motor kicking on, that we will soon wake to true life. I had somehow, without knowing it, managed to hear such a promise in the hoots and bellows of the boys outside. Now they sounded different to me. The very heedlessness of their voices defined the distance that had opened up between us. That easy, brimming gaiety already seemed impossibly remote. No longer the true life I would wake to each morning, but a paling dream. My shirt was soaked through. I could smell myself. I got up and prowled the room, looked blindly at the titles of the books on the shelves, then saw two copies of the school paper on the desk. I started reading Summer Dance, and when the door opened, I whipped around like a thief. Mrs. Busk stood in the doorway. "Are you all right, dear?" I wasn't sure what she meant. I nodded. "Would you like a glass of apple juice? It's nice and cold."
"No, thank you."
"They should be back soon."
"Yes, ma'am."
"All right. Let me know if you want a glass of juice." When she closed the door again, I folded up the paper and put it in my jacket pocket, then sat down to wait. Mr. Ramsey came back alone. He had my largest suitcase and my overnighter. Mrs. Busk asked me to sign a form of some kind. I didn't read it, and then she followed us to the door of her office. She was actually wringing her hands. Mr. Ramsey stopped in the hallway. "Did you give Mrs. Busk your locker combination, then?"
"No, not yet."
"Well," Mr. Ramsey said.
"I'm thinking," I said. But I wasn't thinking. Could only look like I was thinking.
"That's fine," Mrs. Busk said. "Really, dear, it doesn't matter. You can send it along later."
"Right," Mr. Ramsey said. "Send it later."
His car was parked behind the building. Two younger boys with tennis rackets saw us come out and quickly looked away. The bags, of course. And Mr. Ramsey's spiritless face, if not my own. "We're going to be rather in anticipo," Mr. Ramsey said. "I thought you'd prefer to spend the extra time at the station, you know, rather than hanging about here." He drove out on the service road, then took a side street through the village. No other boys saw me leave.
The air was a glaring white haze above the fields. Mr. Ramsey drove as if into a blizzard, slowly with both hands, peering tensely over the steering wheel. The windows were open and some newspapers on the back seat, riffled in the breeze. A pickup truck came up close behind us, dogged us through a series of curves, then made a chancy pass on a short straightaway, and barely avoided an oncoming car.
"Tell me," Mr. Ramsey said, "is that a genuine first edition of In Our Time?"
I told him it was, and then, unable to stop myself, asked if he'd packed it.
"It's in your Gladstone. Quite a treasure, that. How'd you come by it?"
"Gift."
"Yes? Well, defend it with your life. It'll make your children rich. If you have any." "So, you're dead keen on the old bull, aren't you?
Well, he's a great writer."
"There are others.
In this century, he's the greatest. Can I ask you a question?"
"You may."
"Why did you censor what he said to you? That wasn't right."
"You don't censor Ernest Hemingway."
"Oh, the blanks."
"Alumni office. They get the final edit of everything that leaves the school. Didn't know that, did you? The News has a big subscriber list. Can't afford to have some captain of industry choke on his biscuit, can we? But I'll admit to some censoring of my own."
A car shot past, horn blaring. Mr. Ramsey honked back, as if to return a greeting.
"Mind you," he said, "the stuff I left out wouldn't have made it past the Vigilance Committee. But that's not why I left it out. Let me say that I do not consider Hemingway the greatest writer of this century. But he is a very great writer indeed, and some of what he said to me was unworthy. At his best, he would never have said it. I'm sure of that. It seemed unfair, even mean-spirited, to make such remarks public. In fact, we probably shouldn't have run the interview at all. You had no right to touch a word of his. It was wrong. What I cut would have been cut anyway. But I certainly take your point." "Was it about my story?"
"Susan Friedman's story, I believe you mean."
"No. My God, no. Everything but. I'm not sure what it was about, except his own unhappiness. He is not a happy man. He is like the wounded lion in Macomber, flexing his claws, looking to take some heads off." "It was still wrong," I said. "This is hardly the time for you to instruct me on a point of honor. Let it go, for Christ's sake."
"Yes, sir," I said, and turned toward the fields.
"Sorry," he said. He drove in silence a while, then said, "Strange word, honor. Can't be spoken aloud. Turns immediately to bilge. Hemingway had that right."
"You don't believe in the honor code?"
"That's not what I said." "But, no, certainly not. Send a boy packing if he breaks the rules, by all means. Plant a boot on his backside. But do please leave the word honor out of it. It's disgusting how we forever throw it about."
I was shocked. I didn't see how the school could work without the honor code, and I said so.
"Make good rules and hold the boys to them. No need to be pawing at their souls. Honor code. Pretentious nonsense."
We were in town now. This gave Mr. Ramsey occasion to go even slower. I watched myself in the storefront windows as we crept along, appearing and vanishing and appearing again. The few people on the street had a squinty, peevish look, but their ignorance of my situation made me feel thankful to them. For once I was glad for how big the world was. And this somehow gave me heart to ask the question I'd been circling ever since we left the school. "What did my father say?"
"Pardon?"
"What did my father say when he heard, you know?"
"Ah, he didn't believe it.
Told the headmaster we didn't know a thing about you, if we thought you'd do anything on the cheat. That you were the most honest person he knew.
He said that?
So I understand. Gave the headmaster an earful. All but called him a liar.
We got to the station well before my train. Mr. Ramsey went to the ticket counter while I waited on the platform with my bags. An old woman in a black dress and white bonnet kept inching up to the edge to peer down the track. Two red caps stood by their carts in the shade behind my bench, talking in low voices, as if in deference to the heat. Otherwise, I was alone on the platform, until Mr. Ramsey came out of the waiting room with my ticket. He waved off my thanks.
Oh, Father, we'll get the bill soon enough.
I'll wait with you if you don't mind.
We don't have to.
He lowered himself to the bench and closed his eyes and leaned back so the sun fell full on his face. Without opening his eyes, he fumbled in the pockets of his wrinkled linen jacket, produced a pack of jetons, shook out a cigarette, then tipped the pack toward me, as if I were not a boy of the school. I couldn't bring myself to take one.
"How come Dean Makepeace wasn't there?" I said.
Mr. Ramsey put the cigarettes back in his pocket. He didn't answer.
"He's the dean. Why didn't he throw me out?"
"Dean Makepeace left school this morning. Mr. Lambert has stepped in as dean pro tem."
"What? He just left?"
"He had some personal matters to attend to, I believe."
"So he'll miss seeing Hemingway?"
"Yes, I suppose he will." We fell into a long silence then. I didn't mind not talking. I was at ease with Mr. Ramsey because he hadn't crowed or condescended, and also because I knew Mrs. Ramsey had carried on a flirtation with Bill White that year. I knew this from reading Bill's notebook, a wail of longing so raw that he hadn't bothered to change or disguise her name. He addressed her directly, as we argue and plead and rebuke while pacing a room alone. By turns cold, gushy, furious, pained, and punishingly repetitive, these pages had not been written to be read. Bill would never let himself be seen like this. He referred to her kisses and described them in lingering detail, but nothing more. And I figured there was nothing more to describe, or he would have done it in these unguarded pages. I couldn't make out exactly what had happened, though I could guess how it started. The two of them talking, kidding around when Mrs. Ramsey came down to the library basement to file some periodicals. An impulsive kiss in the stacks. Then other kisses. Maybe even in Bill's study. It was a schoolboy fantasy, one of my own, in fact, come true. Until Mrs. Ramsey woke up and ended it. I suspected that Mr. Ramsey knew. It was just a feeling I had. But whether he knew or not, I did. And this somehow allowed me to be easy in his presence. The platform began to fill. The old woman in the white bonnet came over to show us her ticket and ask if her train had already come and gone without her. I told her it was my train, too, and that it hadn't yet arrived. A little while later, I saw her showing her ticket to another man. Mr. Ramsey bent forward and rubbed his eyes.
"What will you do?" he said.
"I don't know."
"Of course. Quite right, too. But you might..."
Then he stopped and never finished the thought. When the train came, he lugged my suitcase on board and put it in the luggage rack at the end of the car. I followed him out to the vestibule, and we shook hands.
"Here one says something," he said. "It's not the end of the world. Be game, you'll work things out."
"But for all I know, you won't work things out."
"How should I know?"
He patted his pockets for the jetons, put one in his mouth, and offered another to me. When I hesitated,
He stuck the pack in my shirt pocket and stepped down onto the platform and walked away, two long sweat stains darkening the back of his jacket. I was glad to see him go. Several minutes still remained before departure time, and I'd worried he might stand vigil outside, watching me through the window, and giving sad little nods whenever our eyes met. A steady line of wilted-looking passengers jostled past me into the carriage. Time to make a move. I pushed through to a forward-facing window seat, claimed it with my overnighter, my Gladstone, took out in our time, and made my way to the smoking car. One for the books. I didn't go home. Instead, I got off the train in New York and cashed in the rest of my ticket and took a room at the Y. The Times wasn't hiring reporters with my qualifications, nor were any of the other papers. They wouldn't even take me on as a copy boy. I finally landed a job bussing tables at a cheap tourist restaurant near Times Square, along with half a bedroom in the head waiter's nearby apartment, where two other waiters bunked in the living room. All three came from Ecuador. Since they didn't speak much English, and I spoke no Spanish, they mostly behaved as if I wasn't there. So did I. This is the job I had when Ernest Hemingway killed himself. He never did visit my school. Too sick to travel. Afterward, I worked as a room service waiter at the Pierre, as a restaurant waiter, a picture framer, and for a short time a Brinks guard. Then for an even shorter time as a plumber's assistant, and again as a waiter. I wrote some wise guy features for an allegedly hip tourist mag that quickly folded, moved five or six times, drank a lot, had a few good friends, and one girlfriend, as faithless as I tried to be. Read many books, signed up for extension courses at the new school, and dropped them all. After almost 3 years of this, I enlisted in the Army and ended up in Vietnam. If this looks like a certain kind of author's bio, there's no accident. Even as I lived my life, I was seeing it on the back of a book. And yet in all those years, I actually wrote very little. Maybe because I was afraid of not being good enough to justify this improvised existence, and because the improvising became an end in itself, and left scant room for disciplined invention. A more truthful dust jacket sketch would say that the author, after much floundering, went to college and worked like the drones he'd once despised. Kept reasonable hours, learned to be alone in a room, learned to throw stuff out, learned to keep gnawing the same bone until it cracked. It would say that the author lived more like a banker than an outlaw, and that his deepest pleasures were familial. Hearing his wife sing as she worked in the garden, unzipping her dress after a party. Seeing his most solemn child laugh at something he said. The brief years of friendship with his father before he died, never once allowing that his son had anything to be pardoned for. It would be very boring. It would also be pointless, merely incidental rather than exemplary. For a writer, there is no such thing as an exemplary life. It's a fact that certain writers do good work at the bottom of a bottle. The outlaws generally write as well as the bankers, though more briefly. Some writers flourish like opportunistic weeds by hiding among the citizens, others by toughing it out in one sort of desert or another. The life that produces writing can't be written about. It is a life carried on without the knowledge even of the writer, below the mind's business and noise, in deep unlit shafts where phantom messengers struggle toward us, killing one another along the way. And when a few survivors break through to our attention, they are received as blandly as waiters bringing more coffee. No true account can be given of how or why you become a writer. Nor is there any moment of which you can say, "This is when I became a writer."
It all gets cobbled together later, more or less sincerely. And after the stories have been repeated, they put on the badge of memory and block all other routes of exploration. There's something to be said for this. It's efficient, and may even provide a homeopathic tincture of the truth. Here is one such story of my own. In the fall of 1965, I got orders for a training course at Fort Holobird, Maryland. As I cleaned out my billet before leaving Fort Bragg, I came across the copy of the news I'd taken from the dean's office the day of my expulsion. I lay back on my bunk and read the story through for the first time in years. It held up well, I thought, but I was no longer in any confusion as to whose story it was, or whose talent Hemingway had blessed. I assumed that Susan Friedman had been told what I'd done. To square things a little, at least with myself, I wrote a brief note of apology and mailed it to her, along with the news, in care of Miss Cobb's alumnae office. Damn if she didn't write back. "Plagiarism, not imitation, is the sincerest form of flattery," she wrote, and thanked me for the further compliment of showing her work to Ernest Hemingway. So old Harry Chest liked it. No one at Miss Cobb's had given her any hint of this distinction. Not, she added cryptically, that this came as any surprise. She found the whole thing a fantastic lark, and thanked me again for letting her in on it. Then in a postscript. "I see you used your own first name in the story, but kept Levine. Interesting touch." That seemed to invite a response. Her return address was in Washington, D.C., less than an hour away, so why not answer her in person? For days I fretted over my next letter, trying to find the exact tone, witty but not frivolous, that would make Susan Friedman accept my invitation to dinner, in partial payment, as I expressed it, of my debt. Within an hour of posting the letter, I was writhing at its juvenility. She wouldn't even answer. But she did, and said that while nights were difficult, she might manage lunch sometime. This sounded like a brush-off, except that she included her telephone number. We agreed to meet at an Italian restaurant on Wisconsin Avenue. I got there early, and Susan was late. So I had plenty of time to pass from elation to despair, as I'd been doing all week. What did I hope for, to be in such a state? I pretended to hope for nothing, just a good meal and some interesting talk. But I couldn't fool myself. This meeting felt momentous to me. It had the potential of making sense of the maze I'd wandered into when I chanced upon her story. Suppose, a ridiculous supposition I knew, but just suppose we fell in love and ended up together. Then it would turn out to have been something more than bad luck that led me to Summer Dance, and all the confusions since would be revealed as cunning arabesques in a most intricate, beautifully formed story. Oh, I knew I should keep my feet on the ground. Knew that my enforced isolation from women had made me vulnerable to runaway dreams. But we already had so much in common. The same story, so to speak. I'd liked her voice when I called to arrange lunch. Cool and low, with an elusive teasing quality. She'd laughed at odd times as we talked, and this flustered me pleasantly, and made me laugh too, as if we both understood something we couldn't say. She was very late. I nursed a beer and looked over the lunch menu, surprisingly cheap for such a busy, sunny place, with snowy tablecloths and heavy silver, and real Italian waiters in black vests. I guessed she'd suggested it to save me money, and for this I was both pleased and suspicious of condescension. Now and then my waiter glanced at me, and I smarted under his gaze. He was young and roosterish, and I knew what he was thinking, that I'd been stood up, and might as well admit it and
either order up or scram. But I held out. And then she was coming toward me, pulling off her gloves. She had a slightly cleft chin and straight dark hair cut in an old-fashioned bob, and wore the black overcoat and red scarf that she said she'd be wearing. Her color was high. She seemed to bring with her some of the crispness of that fine November day. She gave the waiter her coat and scarf, and we shook hands and sat down together. I expected her to make some excuse for being late. But instead she reached into her purse and brought out a pack of Luckies. "This is one for the book," she said, and laughed. "Having lunch with my own personal plagiarist." I lit her cigarette. She stopped my wrist with her hand, and my breath caught. But she just wanted to see the lighter. She turned it over, squinted at the unit insignia on its side, then fished a pair of glasses from her purse and studied it again. She had a soft, fleshy prettiness like girls in silent films, and the clunky black frames of her glasses did not make her any less pretty, only more vivid, as she certainly knew. "Hmm," she said, and handed the lighter back and turned that studying gaze on me. I saw that she had a lazy eye. "You don't look anything like I thought you would," she said. "Neither do you," I said, in revenge. But it was true. I had thought of her as leaner, sharper, a little wolfish. "I won't ask what you were expecting," she said. "Then I won't either." "Do they make you cut your hair like that?" "Yes, but it isn't much different from the way I used to wear it." "Well, that's okay," she said. "I don't like long hair on men." She asked me about the unit I served with and why I joined the army. I picked my way through the answer, afraid of striking a false note. My carefulness bored her. She glanced over the menu while I trailed off. Then I said, "It's something I thought I should do." "For God and country," she said, eyes still on the menu. "No, it was an expectation I had of myself. I would have always felt like I'd missed a base if I hadn't done it." "I'm going to have the tuna salad." She put the menu down and looked at me. "Why do you think you had that expectation?" When I told her I didn't exactly know, she laughed and said, "You don't exactly know? Well, I do." But when I asked her what she knew, she smiled like a big sister, holding something over her little brother's head, just out of reach, and would not tell me. And that was how it went from there. My case was hopeless. Susan had 5 years on me, which didn't have to mean anything in itself, but did mean something because of what she'd done with that time. From Miss Cobbs, she got a free ride to Wellesley, but dropped out after a semester when her mother was diagnosed with cancer. Susan looked after her sister and their mother until she died 2 years later, then worked at different jobs while finishing her degree. She didn't return to Wellesley. She went to Ohio State to stay closer to her sister and was now in her second year at Georgetown Medical School. I saw that she was an extraordinary person, and that I had nothing to offer her but an hour or so of good company, which proved easier once I no longer felt the tension of hope. As we ate lunch, we talked about our school days. Susan took a hard view of Miss Cobbs and also of my own school, which she remembered well from joint concerts and dances. Boys dropping hints of their importance within moments of meeting her, then triangulating her own position from an unvarying progress of questions about friends, parties, and vacations. Boys forcing themselves on her as if she had no choice in the matter. And then, if she held them off, exchanging signs with other boys to be relieved of her, even on occasion abandoning her on the dance floor. Their refusal to discover whether she could think or even talk. Their transparent designs, and appalling confidence. Susan considered my caper with her story a fine joke on this ivy-covered stud farm, and on Papa, as she acidly called him, and on the idea of literature as some kind of great phallic enterprise, like bullfighting or boxing. Change a few names and pronouns, and Papa himself, the peerless measurer of penises. Why the funny face? Hadn't I read A Movable Feast? Papa himself couldn't tell if he was reading the story of a boy or a girl. So much for the supreme arbiter of manhood, not to mention his built-in shit detector. And so much for the supposedly basic differences between the sexes, by which our schools justify their absurd existences. It was a terrific prank, she said. But what in the world made you think of it? This put me in a corner. I understood that whatever curiosity had drawn her to this lunch hinged on her belief that all these subversions were deliberate. What would she think if I told her I'd loved both Hemingway and my school, and that playing them for fools had never crossed my mind? How could I explain that it hadn't been just Ernest Hemingway, but I myself who couldn't tell us apart? It was all too complicated and hardly plausible, less so than Susan's version, to which I sensed she was attached with a ferocity I shouldn't provoke. With a modest shrug, I let things stand. You used your own name, she said. That's smart. That always gets them eating out of your hand. You kept Levine, though. I guess you needed a Jewish name for the story to work. But still, you're not Jewish, are you? Good question, I said. It depends on what you mean by Jewish. Here at last, I gathered myself to do some truth-telling. But Susan cut me off with a laugh. Son, if it depends on what I mean by Jewish, then you're not Jewish. She turned and signaled the waiter. Oh, sorry, she said. I've got a heavy date with Agnes. She laughed again when she saw my face. My cadaver. Oh. Anyway, I'm flattered that you put my poor effort to such good use. It isn't a poor effort. It's a fine story. Nah, it's a well-written little exercise in unhappiness and spite, that's all. It's not just well-written. It's brave and honest. How do you know it's honest? I looked at her. How do you know it isn't a sham from start to finish? I guess I don't. The waiter came with a bill and gave it to Susan. He didn't even glance in my direction. Please, I said. This is on me. She counted some bills onto the table. Gotta support the troops. She must have sensed my humiliation, because she reached over and gave my hand a squeeze. You get the next one, she said, though I knew there wouldn't be a next one. Tell me, you really did like that story? It's terrific. I'd read anything by you. There's nothing to read. You don't write? Not for years. That's sad. No, not at all. Well, it makes me sad. You'll pull through. She stood up and I stood with her. The waiter helped her on with her coat, and when she said mille grazie, he all but purred. We walked outside and stopped in front of the restaurant. Susan gave me a hug. You be careful, she said. Is it a sham? Mustache, she said. You should keep writing. Don't think so. Too frivolous, know what I mean? It just cuts you off and makes you selfish and doesn't really do any good. This actually shocked me. We know what is sacred to us when we recoil from impiety. And Susan's casual desertion of her gift had exactly that force. She saw I was about to say something. Just one gal's opinion, she said, and waggled her fingers and headed up the street. I visited a couple of bars on M Street and worked up my answer to Susan. By the time I got back to the barracks that night, I had it cold.
Her problem was not with writing, but with men. Her patricidal tone when she said, Papa. Some interesting bitterness there. And though she ridiculed the notion of literature as a phallic enterprise, she obviously suffered from that confusion herself. The problem was how she looked at things. The fact that a writer needed solitude didn't mean he was cut off or selfish. A writer was like a monk in his cell praying for the world, something he performed alone, but for other people. Then, to say it did no good, how could she say that? Of course it did good. And I stood there half drunk and adrift in this bay of snoring men and gave thanks for all the good it had done me. Bulletin. I figured the school had washed its hands of me, spat me out for good. But eventually the old boys' office got my range and started pumping out the alumni bulletins. Over the years, they invited me to reunions and glee club concerts and championship hockey games and archaeological cruises in the Aegean, asked me to send in poignant memories of a retiring master, news of recent successes for the class notes. I never made it to these musters of the Corps, nor advertised my progress, but I read every bulletin from cover to cover. Thus I learned of Jack Broom's death while landing his A-6 on an aircraft carrier, and of George Kellogg's Rhodes Scholarship, and his march to the philosophy departments of Penn and Yale and Stanford. Purcell sent nothing in, but Big Jeff did, regularly. He'd gone into computers early on, and now he had his own famous company. In one of his postings, he included a picture of two men standing before a background of distant mountains. The caption read, Cousin Roundup, Big Boots and Little Boots Purcell, 61, on Little Boots' ranch in Idaho. Ride them dogies. Big Jeff had his arm around Purcell's shoulder and was smiling with undisguised love. Purcell looked stoical. He was whip-thin, and his face had gotten long and bony. An interesting face. I considered getting in touch by sending him the in-our-time he'd given me, but didn't. I never saw a word about Bill White. Dean Makepeace died of a heart attack in 1967 while walking to class. He was 69. It surprised me to read in the memorial issue that he had recently married one of the school's secretaries. I didn't recognize her in the cover photograph, a plump woman with big round glasses sitting beside him in the football stadium, a single plaid blanket on their knees, both of them yelling and waving pennants. I spent long minutes over that picture. Dean Makepeace carried away by a woman and a game. The article mentioned his service in Italy during World War I, and ran a sepia picture of a lean, unsmiling young soldier in puttees standing beside an ambulance. He had come to the school in 1930 and taught there ever since, except for a leave of absence in 61-62, the year after my expulsion. Generations of boys, the piece concluded, will never forget his kindness in times of need, even as they quake to recall the famous blue gaze falling on them in class, and the inevitable question, and you, what do you think? The headmaster retired in 1968, was replaced by a man from Exeter who left after just 2 years. And then Mr. Ramsey became headmaster. It was he who arranged the so-called partnership with the failing Miss Cobb's Academy, which for all practical purposes ceased to exist. Now our mud-caked quarterbacks shared the bulletin's photo spread with girls sliding into home, lunging for the heart with fencing foils, and crossing the stage on graduation day to rake in the prizes. It was Mr. Ramsey who started the exchange programs with schools in St. Petersburg and Tokyo, and who, not long ago, invited me back as a visiting writer.
When the invitation came, I felt an almost embarrassing sense of relief. I didn't know I was waiting for it, though I must have been. But then I had second thoughts. I couldn't make up my mind to accept. My family urged me on. Of course I should go. How could I pass up the chance to return in honor to a place I'd left in disgrace? As a writer, how could I refuse to bring the story to so satisfying and shapely a close? Maybe that shapely close was part of what held me back. The appetite for decisive endings, even the belief that they're possible, makes me uneasy in life, as in writing, and may have accounted for some of the dread I felt at the thought of going back.